Hello, and welcome to the EcoMedics podcast, where we explore how the health of our planet affects the health of the people on it, and how we, as healthcare professionals, have the power to lead the way in curbing the climate crisis and to be pioneers in building sustainable healthcare systems. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Ashling, a junior doctor and member of the EcoMedics team, and we have an incredible lineup of guests who will be joining me on each episode to share their experience and expertise about health and the environment. On our final episode of the series, we're fortunate enough to have Tamsin Ellis join us to discuss sustainability in the context of general practice. Tamsin is a general practitioner, or GP, based in London. Since recognising during GP training the severe health implications of an imminent climate catastrophe, Tamsin has poured her efforts into bringing this knowledge to the forefront of general practice. She has created advisory groups, bringing together practices across the UK, and is co-chair of the National Greener Practice Group. She is currently working as an associate for the Centre for Sustainable Healthcare, and has developed and facilitates the UK's Sustainable Primary Care course. Tamsin is an advocate for recognising climate change as a health emergency and considering environmental sustainability when delivering patient-centred care in general practice. She has an impressive following on her social media, at Climate GP, where she shares information about healthcare sustainability and practical ways towards net zero in general practice. Tamsin, welcome to the EcoMedics podcast, and thank you so much for being part of the first series.
Thanks for having me.
I always like to find out a bit about what led people into working within sustainability. Was there a pivotal moment for you, would you say, in recognising the climate emergency, or has it slowly developed?
So I don't think I've got that exciting a story, but hopefully I've got a bit of a relatable story for other people who are working in healthcare, which is essentially that around the time of sort of 2018, 2019, where lots of things were in the news, Extinction Rebellion was sort of staging their protests, it seemed like it was on all the newspapers, I started becoming interested in climate and reading about it. And I kind of went into this state of shock that I didn't realise quite how massive the climate crisis was and just how much it was going to affect the future. And I just thought, I can't not do something. So I started to look into what I could do. And I was just kind of a GP trainee at the time. I hadn't done anything before like this. And I literally Googled, what should I do about climate change? And I went onto, I think it was sort of the UN website, and it said, you should go to your work and find out, you know, maybe divest your pension or do something like that. And I thought, I wonder if the NHS is doing anything, thinking I might be breaking the mould in approaching the NHS, and very quickly discovered that there was lots going on in the NHS and lots going on in sustainable healthcare. But I couldn't really find anything that was going on in primary care, and I was struggling to find other GPs involved. So I did lots of emailing and reached out to lots of people, and found out that the RCGP, the Royal College of General Practitioners, had started an advisory group. And as part of that, they were sort of creating a policy around the fact that they'd declared a climate emergency and they were trying to make a 10-point plan. And through that, I met lots of amazing people who pointed me in the right direction. And I started doing lots of things on the back of that that's got me to kind of having a job in sustainability now.
I think that's quite an interesting way to get involved. And like you said, that is relatable. It was similar for me where I kind of knew that the climate emergency was an issue. I didn't quite realise how soon it was about to start sort of coming into fruition, to be honest. When you mentioned there about that state of shock, that took me back to the feeling that I had as well. So I do think that is kind of what most people experience when they first get involved in these things. And also it's just great that you got involved straight away, because it can be a bit of a minefield trying to figure out where to even start. So yeah, getting involved with a group and making it relatable to things that you're doing, I think is probably just a really great way to start, to be honest.
Yeah, and it can be incredibly lonely. You know, you're there going, the world's going to end, I can't do anything about it, and you're kind of feeling quite stuck. And actually, one of the best things that's happened is I've met people who are feeling the same as me, but kind of taking action and doing things. And that was a real community feeling that I hadn't experienced before. So actually, that state of shock and loneliness really transformed quite quickly when I started to meet people. But totally, as you say, you kind of, you know, are thinking, what can I do? And I want to take action now.
So you're a GP based in London. Could you tell us a bit about the work that you're doing around sustainability within GP? Because you're quite front runner, I think, within this area.
Well, I don't know about that, but so I'm a salaried GP in London, in North London, and I work 2 days a week in general practice, and then I work the other 2 days of my working week. One of the days I work in North Central London ICS. The ICSs are these sort of big areas that have come together in primary care. It's a fairly new thing in which they're trying to bring what was CCGs into the ICS, the integrated care system, and create plans. And as part of that, you might know from previous people you've had on that we have to create these green plans. And so I've been helping with the primary care side of that across North Central London, which is 5 boroughs in London. And then on the other day, I kind of do a bit of work with the Centre for Sustainable Healthcare, which does lots of training, education, developing resources for sustainability. And I also co-chair the National Greener Practice Group, the UK's Sustainability Primary Care Network. Sorry, these are all quite wordy, aren't they? But we essentially are groups across the UK. I think there's 27 and counting groups that are locally working together to sort of have that community feeling. But also nationally, we have special interest groups to try and help think about how we resource this within primary care, think about how we work together to share ideas. And so that national group comes together to try and steer what we're going to focus on at the national level and how we have a voice and advocate for primary care within sustainability.
I know within the hospitals now, there needs to be somebody on the Chief Executive Board that is a representative for green healthcare and achieving our net zero plan. Is there an equivalent in GP?
So unfortunately, GP just often likes to do things quite differently, and we are funded and set up very differently to secondary care. So currently, there isn't any mandate to have that. Some ICSs do have primary care leads, so I think it's becoming more normal, but not every ICS has a primary care lead. And we also have the Royal College of General Practitioners has started recruiting faculty leads, so that would have local leads, but again, that's an unpaid role. So I think it's not been quite so constructed the way that the hospitals are, that to have somebody who's actually got a paid role or having time that's sort of set out for it within primary care to do this. But I think there are places that are much further ahead and places that are behind, just with many things in the health sector.
Do you feel as a GP you're being left out a bit of the plan and that you're having to create ways to become involved yourselves, or is it just that there's a bit of a bigger challenge in order to try and get procedures and policy in place within GP?
So I think general practice is really difficult because we often do feel like we're left out and we're 90% of the patient care, but we get 10% of the funding. Having said that, it's a huge workforce and lots of people really energized and want to do this work. So I think within primary care, we are part of the plans, and that is within the sort of 9 sections of the Green Plan that people have had to work on. Something that I'm really proud of is in South East London, we worked with Greener Practice and the Centre for Sustainable Healthcare on a Green Plan specific for primary care, and in which we went through each of the areas and said what a green health service would look like within primary care. So there, and Cheshire and Mersey have been doing some great work. Cornwall's done some great work. There's things happening in Wales, Scotland. So lots of people are really driving this forward. I think it's just often the kind of the simpler answer. Primary care is a difficult place to make changes because we're all small businesses. Whereas, trust, you can say we're going to do this as a trust, and that's normally one person in charge of that, or a team of people. And again, in primary care, it's kind of just individuals deciding whether they're going to put their energy to it.
Can you tell us a bit about what the GP hotspots are in terms of sustainability? Are there certain areas that you focus on and trying to reach out to different practices to try and encourage people to work on that?
When I think about primary care sustainability, you've got the kind of side that's the impacts on health. So, seeing the people that are coming into our practice and how they're impacted. And I know you've had people talk about that before. So there's kind of addressing that side of things. And then there's the kind of effects from the health service and the emissions that we're creating within primary care. So we know that about 60% of the carbon emissions in primary care are coming from the clinical side, and that's basically what I kind of concentrate on. There's a lot of work going on the non-clinical side, which is that 40%. And our huge impact, our biggest hotspot by a long way, is pharmaceuticals. So that's kind of up to 60% is coming from the medications that we prescribe, alongside, the other things that are hotspots in across the whole health service. So travel and transport, including staff travel, and energy use and business services and other parts of the work that we do within general practice. So I think a huge amount of work is trying to be focused around pharmaceuticals just because it's so much of our carbon footprint. And there's lots of work going on at the moment within inhalers, because there's been nationalised targets in England, at least, to look at how we look at respiratory prescribing, and how we look at emissions as well as good care.
And I think that's had quite a lot of media attention recently as well, about this, the massive burden that the inhalers are having, particularly the metered dose inhalers. It's a project that I got involved with my GP practice as well. And it seems like there's some real momentum picking up about it now, and patients as well as GP staff are becoming more aware of it. In case there's people that don't know about that yet, are you able to share with us a bit about what that burden is and why we're trying to focus on switching away from the DPIs or inhalers in general, why they're such an important part of working towards sustainability in general practice?
So the carbon footprint of the propellant inhalers, the metered dose inhalers, that one that you might commonly see, the kind of Ventolin or Clenil, those kind of inhalers, have a much higher carbon footprint than the dry powder inhalers. And we're probably more used to prescribing the MDI, the propellant inhalers, particularly in GP, but across healthcare. And so I think a big part of the change is looking at why we're doing that in the first place and what's better for patients. In terms of the switching, it's A, to kind of make sure people are on the right device for them and on the right treatment. But B, it means that you'll have a much lower carbon footprint. And it's also one of the key areas within general practice in which we have a high level of the carbon footprint is coming from inhalers. So that's been a kind of national thing that's been looked at, and it was brought up when they sort of developed the net zero plan as well, that inhalers was kind of a focus of the work. So there's groups doing that in lots of different ways, and there's lots of projects that people have been working on. And if people can't have a dry powder inhaler, the other option is there's lower carbon footprint metered dose inhalers. So things like Salomol instead of Ventolin is a much lower carbon footprint. It's about half the carbon footprint of Ventolin. So it's just a lot of this is just kind of raising awareness and educating people so they can know about it. Because if you don't know about it, then you keep on prescribing as you always have.
Are you able to give us an idea of just how much of a difference there is between the metered dose and the dry powders?
If you go onto the greeninhaler.org website, there's a really good infographic that people may well have seen, which shows the kind of equivalent miles. And it's got that if you have a metered dose inhaler, that propellant inhaler, and it's 170 miles, the equivalent of London to Sheffield. Whereas if you have a dry powder inhaler, the one that's got the medication inside as a tablet form, then it's 4 miles. So the same as where I'm in London, just down the road. So that's kind of quite a stark difference.
That's huge. And I think, am I right in thinking it's 5% that the inhalers are responsible for in terms of the GP carbon footprint?
Yeah, it's about that. Yeah, so it is a significant part of what we're doing.
I know that there's some incentives as well now for GP practices that are national to encourage GP practices to try and reduce their inhaler emissions, which is, I think, really positive in order to get people on board. Unfortunately, money does actually work when it comes to these kind of things.
So I think the number one thing I want to say about inhalers or, you know, greening respiratory care is that this is all about good care. So we want to make people's respiratory conditions better managed, better controlled, and help people have a better understanding of their respiratory conditions. So that's the number one thing within sustainability. The carbon emissions and things like that are kind of a byproduct. But I suppose what might be helpful is with Greener Practice and the Health Foundation, we developed a toolkit that Dr. Archie Bansal, who's a GP in Sheffield and founder of Greener Practice, sort of led on. And within that, we looked at 4 areas of inhaler prescribing. So that looked at diagnosis. So, you know, are we making the right diagnosis? I'm sure many of the healthcare professionals listening to this will know about, you know, someone's just given a salbutamol inhaler and that reliever inhaler, and it just keeps on being prescribed and there's not really a diagnosis associated with it. Looking at disease management. So that was the majority of the things that we created within the toolkit to try and help people, which is to say, you know, how do we get people feeling better, having less symptoms, making sure they're having their reliever inhalers. And then we looked at device choice. So this is the big thing that people like talking about, is the kind of switching inhalers. So going from a metered dose inhaler, which is that propellant puffer inhaler that contains the hydroxyfluorocarbons, which have a greenhouse gas effect, and switching it to a dry powder inhaler, which has a lesser carbon footprint. So that's the kind of one that people tend to bring up and talk about. And that's that decision has to be made with the patient, and that has to be made that they can use the device, and there's lots of things that you can do to help you do that safely. And then the final thing is disposal, because we know lots of people are throwing away devices that have still have medication in them and that have, a greenhouse gas effect. So within the toolkit that we developed, we tried to make it kind of off-the-shelf quality improvement projects to help people make those changes safely so that it would be a sustained change, and in conjunction with the patient, you know, having lots of patient information leaflets and things like that. So the inhalers becomes very complicated really quickly, but the simple thing is that we want people to be on the right device, and we want people to know how to use it, and we want people to have well-managed conditions, and we want to prevent deaths from respiratory conditions, in particular asthma deaths. So that's kind of the work that's going on. The incentivized change from the national level is that we want people to have a look at, so it's part of the IIF fund, which stands for something, but it's a fund that looks at trying to get more people onto the DPI, the dry powder inhalers. And we know from other countries that that can be done safely. So places like Sweden have a much, they prescribe pretty much all DPI inhalers, whereas in England we're prescribing kind of 80% metered dose inhalers, and often that was done on a cost basis.
Yeah, and I think from a patient's perspective as well, when I was getting involved in this, I was a bit apprehensive about what the response would be for patients, because I think it can be quite difficult to change people's medications when they've been on it for a really long time. But actually what I found is when I was speaking to patients about changing over to these inhalers, there was such an impressive response, where people were sort of, because I think because we know that the dry powder alternatives are as effective, and we're able to say that and reassure them that their condition isn't going to change, and we're able to still manage their symptoms on these new inhalers. The fact that it's something that can massively reduce their carbon footprint, and it's something we're trying to work towards, seemed like it was enough for people to want to change, and people just seem really motivated to think, well, if it's going to really change my carbon footprint and my impact on the planet, I definitely want to get involved. And is that the experience that you've had? Because I think that seems like it could be one of the biggest challenges in making these kind of big changes from a patient's perspective.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult because lots of environmental things are quite emotive and people can have big reactions. And as you say, my experience has been that people are really open to talking about it. I did a really interesting project with some medical students at my previous practice, and they just sort of had phone calls with patients. And on the whole, people were very open to talking about it. When I have conversations with patients, I don't really bring up the environment. I just say, can we have a chat about your inhalers? How are you getting on? And have that conversation around dry powder versus metered dose. Because I think the difficulty is you don't want to come in saying, we want to put you on an inhaler because it's environmentally friendly. We want to try and help people make the right decisions. But actually, when you say, oh, and just to let you know, it's more environmentally friendly, people are normally really up for it and want to do it. That's also backed up by evidence. Asthma UK did a big study that showed that patients do want this and do want to know about it. So I think, you know, often it's about trying to ask the question, you know, and let patients be empowered to make those decisions themselves.
And is there anything else that's really important that GPs should focus on when they're looking at trying to work towards reducing the carbon footprint of their practices?
So there's more and more resources, and there's just lots of stuff out there that can help people think about it. So one of the key things that we sort of encourage people to do is look at what's called the Green Impact for Health Toolkit. And that's being run in conjunction with the RCGP, but was originally from a student organisation and is now by SOS charity. And you can go on there and you can register as a practice, as a locum, in whatever way you want. And there's lots and lots of ideas on there, and you can get awards. So with my previous practice, we were very excited to get a bronze award that year that we were making changes. And it's really brilliant to go on there and get ideas. And that's anything from looking at your water use, to looking at what food you're getting in, to looking at equipment, to energy. There's just lots and lots of ideas on there. There's also the GP free carbon calculator for non-clinical carbon that's been developed by Sea Sustainability. Again, you can register to use that and you can carbon footprint your practice. And there's just even more things. If you have a look at the Greener Practice website, there's lots and lots of resources on there in which you can have a look at kind of the baseline of your practice and then look at making changes.
I found from personal experience in my GP practice that I worked at over the last couple of years, that was something that we did as part of the green team. And during our meetings, we would sort of set a task for before the next meeting. We'd have a look at that website and try and pick something that we feel interested in or that we'd like to take a lead on. And it's just really great for bouncing about ideas and picking up different areas that perhaps you hadn't even thought about. And I think some areas are a bit easier to try and implement. I think things like trying to encourage cycling and having more plant-based options in the canteen. But some of the bigger things like switching over the energy supply can be a bit challenging. Is there any advice that you'd give for those kind of big steps?
So I think you sort of described it there of having a weekly agenda item is a really good way of starting small. So I think the big steps are hard, but it's really important to start that momentum because actually people see change. And when you see change being affected, it's really powerful. The other thing that I would really suggest is sort of creating a green team. I don't know in your practice who is involved, but it worked much better from when I was in a training practice and trying to do it on my own and then starting with a salary GP. And, you know, there was a nurse lead, there was me, there was an admin lead. And suddenly you've got a team of people around you who are looking for those solution focused things. The other thing that I'd say was really helpful is getting involved with the local authority. So often councils might be able to help you with an energy meter, or there might be grants available. So those kind of things can be really useful. And now we've got the ICS green plans, often approaching ICSs and looking what they can do to support, because I think more and more the green teams within that are looking at how we might look at an area and look at, you know, could we look at everybody's energy suppliers, or could we look at different ways of doing things? And again, how do we share that amongst maybe bigger practices that are able to spend the time doing that and help smaller practices? So I think that would be my kind of top things is start small, get a team and look at what support and resources around you.
And that team element is also really important to try and cross over the different areas within the practice as well. So we had the pharmacy team involved. When we're talking about things like inhalers, having the respiratory nurses involved as well is also really important. We had some people from the reception team so that we could get some of the logistics involved as well, because it, like you said, it can be really hard to try and do these kind of things on your own. And actually, just on that topic, I listened to a talk that you gave for the BBC last year as part of their For Thought series. Which is brilliant, by the way, for anyone listening. I'd really recommend it. It's a really engaging 20-minute talk where you illustrate the issues of environmental sustainability in GP, but so wonderfully you sort of take us through you on a day of seeing patients. Really great and easy to listen to. But something you said on that was that in your practice there is this sort of heart sink moment for your colleagues sometimes when you give another talk on the environment, or sometimes there's a bit of disinterest from people sometimes because, you know, there's so many pressures on GP and that you're the one bringing up the climate constantly and there's that feeling. So having lots of people involved just takes that pressure off you having to be that one advocate that seems to constantly be hammering the point, I guess. I don't know if that is a good summary of what your talk was about, but that was something that I really picked up on, and I felt that that resonated with me. I feel like the only person sometimes in the room thinking about the climate side of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that. I think people often talk about feeling like the only green in the room, and I think it's just important that we talk about it, really, because even with my friends and family, I'll bring it up and they'll be kind of rolling their eyes going, here she goes again. And I think it's important that we do acknowledge that, and that we think about innovative different ways of introducing it into the conversation that isn't just going, oh, but did you know there's a climate crisis? Do you know that we need to act now? Because actually, I think so much of healthcare sustainability needs to not feel additional, particularly in primary care. And that's the place that I know. But, you know, it's really hard at the moment. We're really struggling. The demand is very high. The staff levels are difficult. There's all these challenges. And so it can be that if you bring it up, people go, not now. You know, we've got COVID, we've got the polio vaccines, we've got all these things happening. That it's important to acknowledge where people are before you start going into asking them to do more. And what I've found in particular is that sometimes what's difficult is you want to almost try and convince the person in the room who's kind of angry in the corner, not wanting you to speak. And actually what I missed is that to go where the energy is of the person who's looking at you and listening to you.
He's actually engaging.
Kind of, yeah. So I think that's the thing, is sometimes it's not about trying to convince people who aren't with you, but just trying to work with where the energy is and go in the direction that people want to go in. And that might not necessarily fit with where the hotspots are. You know, we often say, you know, well, the hotspots prescribing, we need to work on that. And we need to, like, as you say, work with pharmacists and colleagues and things. But actually what people really want to talk about is the waste. And people have a really strong feeling about how much we throw stuff away. And at the beginning, I found that really difficult because I was like, that's not where the emission hotspots are. Mm. But actually doing those initial things, like I said, when you can see it, might then bring people into the conversations that later down the line, you can do a bit more of that carbon literacy of, well, this is actually where our impact is. So I think that was a big learning curve for me as well, was just to not be downtrodden by the people who are finding you boring or annoying. So it's about bringing people with you and doing that in a way that feels inclusive.
I'm aware that there's more to talk about in terms of GP hotspots, but I just want to pick up on what you mentioned there about the pressures, and we've got COVID and we've got all these other things. Can we talk a bit about that? Because I am reluctant to talk politics too much on this podcast, but it's hard to avoid, I think, when we're talking about the landscape of GP right now. And it's hard to ignore the scapegoating that's happening in the media, where GPs are, I would say, getting the brunt of so much blame for a lot of the failings of the NHS. Obviously, we're in a really difficult and potentially pivotal part of the health service right now in the UK. And I think GPs are getting vilified enormously, where you're probably working 2 to 3 times as hard, maybe more, but being accused sometimes of not delivering very good care. Sorry, that's a really long-winded way of me just saying that I can imagine it's really, really challenging to be a GP right now. And I know that there's a big feeling of burnout. And is this difficult to keep fighting for and keep trying to bring to the forefront with all of that going on? Are people just so exhausted that they don't have the energy to talk about these kind of things?
So I think that's very accurate, and thanks for saying it, because I think it is a difficult time for general practice. I think there's two sides to this. So I think there's obviously the challenges that we're facing. I was literally in the practice till about 9:10 last night. So I think, you know, it's really difficult that then you go on Twitter and you read people saying, why GP wouldn't see me, when I've been literally back to back seeing people. So I think there's the kind of what's happening in the media and what we're facing, and just it just being a really difficult place to work right now, and there being real pressure, and that we're seeing, you know, I don't know if you saw recently in the news that a GP had killed herself, and that was, you know, what the news story was the other day, and lots of GPs really felt that sense of what burnout looks like. So it's really scary. And I often, when I give presentations to practices who are brand new to this, put up a slide that says we've got a meeting of two crises. We've got the climate crisis and we've got the GP crisis. And GPs are really struggling at the moment. On the other hand, what I'd say to sort of not keep it all doom and gloom is that, yeah, sure, it's difficult. Sure, the demand is high. Sure, patients are expecting a lot. And we've got all the difficulties of what we're being portrayed as in the media when we're working the hardest we've ever worked. And that's what the stats would show. I found doing sustainable healthcare has completely transformed how I live my life and how I practice, and has really helped me. So I think, you know, I started cold water swimming because I read about blue prescriptions that were all to do with getting in nature and blue and green spaces and water. I started going to a community garden. I have met some fantastic, inspirational people who've made me really think about the things within my life. And I started, I went to some trauma-informed care training. I looked at health creation work, and suddenly I've got a completely different perspective on what general practice is to me and who I am as a GP. And all of that I don't think would have come unless I'd got involved in sustainable healthcare. It gives me a huge amount. I feel more rewarded in my job. It can be really hard and the day can be long, and I'm not saying I get it right all the time. But when I'm in GP and I'm looking at it with that sustainable lens, I think it makes me have a better day. And I think that's the kind of thing that I keep hearing from people, is actually it's a really nourishing environment to be in, to think what you're doing here is trying to do person-centered, holistic care, in which you're making people and planet better. Like there's kind of a real positive there. And we talk a lot about trying to get the joy back into general practice, and that's really hard at the moment. But I've found that doing sustainable healthcare in some ways, on some days, feels like that happens. And that's what I'd say to encourage people to join in this movement, is that there are different ways of viewing work and even your own life.
That's really positive to hear. What I'm hearing as well from what you're saying there about the different lens that you now have when you've got the perspective of sustainability is also the fact that all of these things are linked. So the fact that there's a pandemic, and the fact that, you know, I guess there's things like the mental health crisis, a lot of that can be linked in some ways with the health crisis, and it's not necessarily separate, and encouraging active transport and encourage people to get out in nature, and what you mentioned about cold water swimming, that's all things that encourage people to connect better with nature. But it's also good for mental health, and it's also, I guess, a way to be addressing public health issues, which is partly what you do as a GP as well. So I wonder whether does it, because for me, I really found that it's speaking on this podcast as well and speaking to different people, I really realise how much treating at the start and the primary care is actually a huge part of actually reducing our carbon footprint as a health service, as the NHS in general, because preventing health problems is one of the best things that we can do in terms of reducing our carbon footprint and reducing the need for health services. So I guess having that lens in primary care gives you that side of things as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's why working with the Centre for Sustainable Healthcare has been really helpful to me to think about that, because I did a course with the Centre for Sustainable Healthcare, absolutely loved it, and I just sort of asked the director, can I just want to get involved? And then she said, well, there's not a course for primary care, do you want to sort of do that? And I was like, I don't know if I can do that, but I'll give it a go. And through that, I learned about the principles of sustainable healthcare, which you may have heard before, but is prevention, patient empowerment, lean service delivery, and low carbon alternatives. And those first two are so important, the prevention and patient empowerment. And I don't think we spend enough time talking about them, because people like talking about the net zero ambulance and everything else. Because I think the criticism that we often get is, you know, why are you talking about the environment? Your GP, get on with your job. And what I'd say is, so many of these things we do already, you know, smoking cessation, diet, weight management, physical activity, all these things are things that we talk about in managing long-term conditions. And all these things are good public health, but also good general practice. So I think that prevention element is really the thing that drives me about thinking about sustainability. It's very difficult to get it into these kind of strategic plans, because, you know, you can name amount of bike racks that you get, but it's very, very difficult to say, you know, how are we going to really think about personalised medicine? How are we going to do that in a way in which we're addressing inequalities and we're helping populations? But as you say, it's such a key factor for what we do in general practice all the time when we're managing lots of risks and we're thinking about how we treat patients and populations.
Holt Doctors is the number one agency for doctors seeking locum work. They have more independent 5-star reviews than any other agency. The team at Holt are some of the most experienced in the industry, dedicated to finding doctors the jobs they really want. Holt has many exclusive contracts across the UK, from Highland to Island and everything in between. This means that not only are they the best agency to find you your perfect job, but they help doctors to get ahead in their career. Holt cares for those who care. To find out how Holt can help you, join them now at holtdoctors.co.uk or download their app. Do you think there is enough emphasis on prevention with the current landscape of healthcare in general, in terms of trying to prevent that healthcare burden in the first place, which is where we could be potentially putting a lot of our efforts? Do you think that is how the healthcare system's set up? Are you finding that in general practice, that there is that prevention element that's leading things?
So I think there's really good intentions, but I guess healthcare is quite reactive. You know, we do things in terms of treating people rather than thinking about what health looks like. We talk about healthcare, but what does a healthy life look like? So I think it's getting there. You know, there's a lot more emphasis on physical activity now. There's obviously the social prescribers who are working in practices. So there's I think a lot more focus on trying to think about communities and how we look at people getting help, which isn't just coming to the GP and getting a prescription. But I think there's always going to be scope to do more prevention work, because actually it happens really early on. We know that if you look after under fives and you know, that's going to create healthier adults. So I think prevention could always be focused on more. And again, it comes down to funding, you know, where that funding is going. And often it's on the people who are needing treatment rather than on the prevention. But I hope that is a core part of what we're doing going forward. And I think that sort of agenda is coming more and more with the funding that's coming in.
And you mentioned there about social prescribers. I don't think I actually know a huge amount about that. Would you be able to just share a bit about what they do and what that involves?
Yeah, so social prescribing is still fairly new, but it should sort of every general practice, every GP or people working in general practice should have access to a social prescriber. And social prescribing is quite a sort of simple thing, but sometimes can be quite difficult to understand exactly what social prescribers are doing. But essentially any sort of intervention that is helping someone's life, that might be things like getting them involved with a voluntary group, or it might be helping them with their benefits, or it might be, helping them find a new skill. So it's looking at those things that are sort of social problems that often come into the GP as sort of physical complaints or combined with physical complaints. And thinking a bit more holistically about how we approach that. And social prescribers have a bit more time with patients, so they can kind of take on the caseload and have a bit more time to sort of goal set with patients and think about what their lives look like and what matters to them. You might, instead of doing a prescription for something, that you might send someone to the social prescriber and think about that, about things that are in their life, rather than going straight to a prescription, I think is the aim of it. But I'm not an expert in social prescribing. I've just found it fantastic to find locally, you know, about what's going on with the parks team and what's going on with vulnerable adults and with kind of social isolation. There's just lots of things that social prescribers can signpost to and help with. And one of the best things that I've seen, that's one of those co-benefits things, is social prescribing in fuel poverty. So I work in quite a deprived area of London, and I've seen some really good things of people saying, I'm really struggling with my bills. And then the social prescribers sort of signpost to fuel poverty services, and then they can help them with the debt, but also help them get a new, more efficient boiler or whatever it might be. And you're doing that kind of win-win of helping someone's health as well as helping, you know, in terms of energy and efficiency.
And is there, would you say, an overall link between social prescribing and improving our impact on the environment?
So I think they come part and parcel with that sort of holistic approach to healthcare, which sustainability is. And I think, again, on those kind of principles of sustainable healthcare, that prevention and patient empowerment part is really helped by social prescribing. I guess it's kind of a low carbon alternative as well. But I think it certainly is definitely a core part of how we think about sustainable healthcare within the clinical sense.
Just to go back to a couple of things that might be focused on in GP, things like air pollution and smoking, is that quite high up on the agenda in general practice?
So I think air pollution's obviously a horrible thing, but a really good thing to bring together those things that I've never really had a conversation about air pollution where people don't agree that it's, you know, it's a health issue. The solutions are often better for people, you know, active transport and things like that. And that we need to address it soon because it's already impacting people right now. So I think it's a kind of really obvious one when you're trying to convince people that that the climate crisis is a health crisis. Air pollution is a really good example of that. There's quite a lot of work going on within primary care. So Global Action Plan have been working in Islington, where I work, on a pilot project to try and educate patients about air pollution, but they've also been working nationally to train people up. And it was amazing. I went to the training and I learned a lot about, you know, these things about that air pollution impacts every organ in the body, that it can, you know, it's currently killing people right now. And I'm sure many people who listen to this will know about the case of Ella Kissy Deborah, the 9-year-old who died from air pollution, which has been, again, a really emotive story to get people thinking and talking. And we've done some work with the RCGP to try and promote that, to say that, you know, that the GPs need to be educated about this and that we need people to be talking to their patients about it. And what's been interesting in the time I've been a GP is people are now coming to me and asking me about it. So I had a father bring their child with asthma in and say, oh, you know, could it be the road that we're living on? And those conversations can be really powerful because, you know, I have to be honest, but there are ways to spend time in cleaner air. So you're kind of having that difficult conversation where you're saying, well, it might be the road you live on, but let's look at ways that we can think about that. And then I guess on the national scale, how do we keep advocating for our patients to say that it's unacceptable, that I think it's 99% of the world now is breathing toxic air.
Gosh. And is obviously there's the side where we're trying to reduce the impact on air pollution, but what are the ways that you suggest to your patients to try and avoid the impacts of the poor air quality that we're experiencing?
So I think there's things about indoor air pollution and outdoor air pollution, and you can find all of the resources, and there's really good kind of leaflets and tick boxes and things on the Global Action Plan website. But I think one of the key things that I sort of talk to people about is that just green routes and trying to say, well, you know, if you're walking to school this route, is there a way that you can go and spend it more on the the side routes you're not going down the busy road, could you spend a day not driving to work, those kind of things that you're trying to get people out of those areas that have high air pollution. There's been a couple of videos where GPs have gone with air pollution monitors to schools and GP surgeries and then gone to parks and shown quite how much of a difference there are. So just having those kind of conversations about where to spend time. I think what becomes difficult is you don't want to go into the process of kind of victim blaming, because some of the things are saying, you know, close your windows at rush hour, and that feels like a really difficult thing to say, because, you know, that's, you know, it's not their fault that people are driving past the house at rush hour. So I think often these things have to have a bit of nuance and be led by the patient, but those are the sort of things that we talk about, and trying to kind of avoid indoor burning and things like that as well.
Would you say there's any link in terms of mental health and the climate crisis? Is that something that's on the GP radar when it comes to working towards net zero?
So there definitely is a link, and the psychiatrists have done some fantastic work on looking at various things that might be the impact, such as people who experience flooding. A lot of, I can't remember the exact stat, but a significant number will go on to have trauma as related to their house being flooded. And then obviously we've got teenagers with climate anxiety and that kind of thing. And then air pollution itself can have an impact on your risk of dementia. And
oh wow, I didn't realise that actually. That's really interesting.
I know, I had a chat with an expert and he said that just the road I live on puts me at higher risk of developing dementia in sort of 20 years time or whatever. It can be quite scary thinking about, you know, your own risk and your patient's risk. So I think mental health is very much on the agenda. I think the other thing, again, trying to flip it round, because I think often we talk about these things and it's all quite doom and gloom and you're going, you know, there's going to be people die and it's awful. But actually the flip side of that is that spending time in nature improves mental health. We know that people doing physical activity improves mental health. I try and have a lot of conversations with patients to say, you know, what's their feeling about their health and their condition, and particularly with mental health, with kind of anxiety, depression, mild anxiety, depression. Could you have a conversation about spending time outdoors or doing activity outdoors? And actually say that the stats on that is that it's really effective and it's one of the best things that we can prescribe. So I think with mental health, there's often that side of things as well. But there's lots of work going on within psychiatry, and there's groups doing things within psychiatry to look at various ways that the impacts of mental health is going to be. And again, it's just being really cautious. You know, I heard recently that a child had been told their inhaler was not environmentally friendly and then stopped taking it. And we just got to be so careful about the messaging that we're giving, to saying, actually, if you look after yourself, if you're health literate and you're trying to help people understand their conditions, that's a really sustainable way of doing it. And we talked about prevention earlier, you know, people keeping themselves well is the best thing that they can do. I haven't seen so much climate anxiety probably because of where I work, but I think that probably will come more with time.
That's something I hadn't really considered, to be honest, about the fact that there certainly is so much climate anxiety, and I think the younger populations are experiencing it quite a lot. And I mean, for myself even, I can sometimes struggle with it as well, but I hadn't really thought about that then having an impact on people coming to their GP with those kind of issues and mental health related to the climate crisis. So in terms of practical ways as a GP, I know you've mentioned there's the toolkits, which are really, really helpful. As I said, I'd definitely encourage people to go and have a look at those if you work within GP to get some ideas. Have you got any tips of areas to focus on if somebody within their GP practice right now wanted to start a bit of movement within their practice, or certain things that they should focus on, or ways that they can make this a priority within their GP practice?
Sure. So I know I'm biased, but I would say sign up to Greener Practice. If there's a group near you, it's often a really good starting point to both meet other people and find out what's happening locally. If there isn't a group, we've written a guide about how to set one up. I set one up in London, and we can try and support people through that. So I would say find a group locally and find out what's happening locally as a starting point. And as you say, be aware of the toolkits and things that exist. I think if you're thinking about a practice-based level, and I think with general practice it's difficult because you could do it at practice, you could do it at sort of borough or whatever your equivalent is, or you could do it at ICS in Scotland and Wales, they're called different things. It's kind of what level you want to go in at and where your passion is for where you want to make change. So let's say it's a practice level. I think it's about having conversations and listening first. And that's really hard to do, especially if you've got lots of ideas. but find, you know, a really good way of finding out initially is getting other people to feedback. That could be through post-its on a wall or whatever, to find out what people care about in the practice mm-hmm. can be a really good way to start. And then, as you said earlier, really helpful if you can put it on an agenda. You know, most practices will have a weekly or kind of a regular meeting. If you can get it onto the meeting regularly and start small, that's a really good way to start. And then feeding back in, you know, because we need the practice-based things, but we need that systems level change as well. Feeding it back in both ways is really important. So finding out if things are happening more at that kind of higher up level, if you have time. There's also kind of more and more things coming out with fellowships and various ways that you could get some protected time to do this, or working with students or working with trainees to do quality improvement. So there's also the Centre for Sustainable Healthcare, as I said, we run a course, or there's the Sustainable QI resources, which can be really good to do a short-term project when you're in primary care as on a placement. So there's kind of just lots and lots of things, but I'd say starting on the Greener Practice website, we try and put everything on there and have it kind of quite user-friendly and happy to kind of support people if they've got questions.
And in terms of small little actions, some examples of what we did in our general practices, we started adding to our weekly order of milk, oat milk, and we did sort of a bit of a survey to see how many people would use it. I'm quite surprised by how many people have been trying it out since we've been ordering it in. So that was one thing that we did, which seems quite small, but it's just like little actions. And then another thing that we did was change all of the browsers to Ecosia, mm-hmm. which is just a really simple change where it's a website that you use instead of Google, and it works really similarly. It looks very similar in terms of the interface, but instead of having ads and investing in Google and potentially fossil fuel investment and that kind of thing, they actually use all of the searches to then fund things like planting trees and switching over things like toilet paper or dishwasher tablets, or something else that we try to do in our practice. So I think there's lots of little things, even if people haven't got necessarily the energy or the confidence to do massive things straight away, there are those little things. And those are the kind of little projects that you can get lots of people involved in, whether it's like the secretary team, the nursing team.
Yeah, so the things that we did, I think, did a similar thing. We had oat milk, we got glass milk bottles, we got our local council to install an energy meter to tell us where we were leaving things on. We looked at changing how we were using our water to try and reduce water waste. We looked at changing our energy provider, and like I said, things like Ecosia. I think what's been really interesting as part of Greener Practice is we have meetings to get that kind of shared learning. And there was an amazing manager recently. It was a big, big sort of set of practices, but he'd looked at getting in printers that were new, because they just have these printers that use lots of toner. And he was like, I don't know if you've ever noticed, if you go into a GP practice, there'll be a whole room full of toner. And actually, if you replace the printers that don't, you know, have much low use toner or no toner, he'd saved in the end $50,000 just on replacing all the printers. And obviously there's the upfront cost of that. But often if you do those cost saving things, because lots of these things are cost saving as well, some people have introduced kill switches that sort of switch off everything at night time. You might get the odd person who says, oh, what about the updates? But normally it's fine. But if you have that, then again, you're saving money on energy, and we know that the cost of energy is going up. So I think that was a really helpful thing at my practice, is initially getting those cost saving things in place first, so that when we looked at those things like switching the milk and the coffee and whatnot that might cost more. What's interesting is that upfront cost that we had of changing our milk and coffee to fair trade, zero waste kind of deliveries ended up saving money, because the waste was less, because we were getting things collected. They told us how much we were using, and therefore overall it was sort of cost neutral, and possibly I left that practice, but possibly it's cost saving. But at the time, you know, that was kind of the decision, was, you know, do we have an upfront cost for this? So that's often, if you're trying to sell it to a practice manager, lots of things are cost saving when you're trying to do things
financial
around waste.
Yeah. And I guess even just creating that kind of culture within the GP practice where those little things are happening and their people are aware of them, and it's just like sort of little daily reminders when they see the Ecosia or where they see the oat milk or whether they see the energy meter or things are turning off. It's just, I guess, that just gentle reminder, and to get people thinking and make sure it's something that's a constant part of the GP practice, and that then can help encourage people to get involved in the bigger projects, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think being a point of call, I don't know what it was like at your practice, whether someone was the kind of person you go to, but things that I'd not even thought about, you know, the nurse said, oh, a couple of patients are asking me about moon cups, do you know about zero waste periods? And suddenly I was finding myself kind of researching on that, and then we got some posters that we put up, and we tried to change about our sanitary pads to be no plastic. So, you know, it's sometimes going with what someone brings to you and just having someone at the practice who's the person who you can have that conversation. It might be that someone's had a thought and gone, well, where do I take that? That can sometimes be a really good starting point. People also talk about kind of patient participation groups, putting things on your website. Froome Medical Practice have a fantastic website with lots of things that they've done to achieve a gold award. So like you say, seeing things often is a really good incentive for people to be doing this. And I spoke to a practice manager this morning and just saying, it's just, you get really energized when you start making changes because people can feel quite good about it. And you know, you're doing something at home, you recycle at
just
home.
Just one thing I wanted work, to you know, that, pick up on as well thing. Before we finish is, when I was again listening to you speak on that BBC talk that you gave, something that really stood out to me was when you mentioned about your confidence when you're talking about these kind of things and prioritising greener practice and how that's grown over the time. And you can talk with so much more conviction now, even when you're walking into a room of really high profile people. And I can say that from my own experience, that really resonates with me. I don't think I've quite got to that stage yet, but I think learning about the urgency of it makes you a bit less apologetic and gives you that confidence to bring it up, because I think it can feel quite scary, especially when you're maybe early on in getting involved in the climate crisis and you've not necessarily been part of different environmental action groups. You might feel that you don't necessarily have that confidence. Is there any advice that you would give on building that, or how people can be able to go forward and not be held back worrying about what people are going to react with and that kind of thing?
Yeah, so I did say to you earlier, I think you're doing a fantastic job. And I think that's the thing, is that we put, as medics, we're used to putting so much pressure to be good and get things right. And I think with this, the evidence is changing so quickly, the information is changing so quickly, it's actually very hard to keep up with what's happening. I think unfortunately, I'm actually very glad. At the time I was annoyed, but I'm actually very glad that I went and did my small room conversations, because I kind of started going to little GP practices and doing little talks here and there and doing really bad ones so that I learned what was working and not working. And in a smaller room, people are much more honest with you about what's working and not working. So I think that's kind of the first thing, is it does just take a bit of practice, particularly if you're not, I'd never done a talk, I'd never done public speaking. So it was really like a brand new thing to me to go and put myself out there. And I'm not really this kind of person that does it. So that was the starting point, was going, I'm going to do this. How am I going to get better at it? And some of that is just getting better slowly.
And failing through it sometimes and not doing the best job.
Exactly. I think being curious as well. So I spent a lot of time talking to people to find out what was happening already. And so just diving in headfirst with being like, I want to do this. How am I going to do it? I tried to find out from people what was working. And then I think a thing that's been really instrumental to just changing a lot of things for me has been storytelling, because I stood up in my first ever gram round and I went, this many people are going to die and it's terrifying and you should all be scared. And it had no impact. I mean, we did form a group and things did happen, but I could sense in the room that people were either switched off or going, what is this person on? And it just didn't work for me. And that's my personal experience. And I met a GP who said, it's all about the stories you tell. And if you put up a picture of Ehrlichiosis Deborah and talk about air pollution and asthma, you're going to get much more engagement than putting up the facts that 7 million people worldwide die a year. It's just how the human brain functions. So as soon as I learned that, completely shifted my talks. And I started talking more about my journey and about the journey of greener practice and about the various organisations I've been involved with. I think it's kind of knowing you can't win everyone over, telling your story is really, really powerful, that you get better with time, and that we're all feeling like imposters still today. You know, I've listened to your other podcasts and I thought, oh, she's got some very impressive guests on here, and not feeling like you're the person who has anything to say. And actually, some of the best conversations I've had have been with medical students coming to the practice and having amazing ideas. So in this movement, it really is a flat hierarchy, because it's not like you've got a consultant leading what's happening. You're all in the same place, we're all living together to try and figure out what the answer is, and there's no one solution.
I've just got some quick fire questions to round up. So if you could give one key piece of advice to people about sustainable living, what would it be?
So initially, I kind of thought about a bit of a woolly answer, which is be thoughtful in everything you're doing. So, you know, if you're going to buy something, if you're going to do something, be thoughtful about sustainability when you're doing it. But I think that's quite a hard, tangible thing. So I think This isn't my advice, but it's something I've heard, which is the three P's. So think personally, professionally, and politically about what you're doing. So, you know, personally, I think about the clothes that I buy, I think about what I'm eating, don't get it right all the time, and just, again, try and have a bit of self-compassion that you can't be perfect. Professionally, you know, can you do something at work? Is that something that you have capacity to do? If you don't, fine. If you do, great, start making those inquiries and those conversations. And again, don't beat yourself up if you don't get everything done all in one go. And then I think we have to think politically as well. And so, you know, we aren't going to do this without huge government shifts. I think I saw that at COP when I was there. So, you know, we can do all these things, but that kind of bottom-up, top-down approach is needed. And so we need to make sure you go out and vote. You need to make sure that you're keeping up to date with things and see if there is any political pressure that you have any influence over.
What do you wish you knew sooner?
So I think I've touched on it already, but I wish I'd known sooner about the power of stories and about the power of connection. I think I tried to do this on my own as a kind of, I'm going to just, you know, put myself out there and be on the right side of history and all these things. And actually it wasn't till I found a group of people who supported me and who I supported and I learnt from. And that's how I sort of ended up doing these roles. And I really enjoyed meeting some fantastic people who've had such brilliant ideas and just work so hard. So I think telling your story, being empathic and honest, and kind of meeting and connecting with other people, I kind of wish I'd joined a group sooner.
And I have to say, following you on social media, I definitely appreciate that you are quite open and honest, and it's not just here are all the facts, there's an element of you in there and there's an element of your journey. And I guess the real challenges of working within this environment of trying to work towards sustainability. And I think that transparency is really relatable. I think that's also really important that we're not just this, you know, this force that's saying climate change is a big thing. We're like real humans that really want to make changes. And that's all part of the storytelling as well. What will you tell future generations about your role in the climate crisis?
I'm not sure. I think this is tricky. I think I hopefully will say that I did all that I could and that I shifted as soon as I knew. And I hope that I will be able to tell people that I collaborated and was part of a group of people who were trying to create a fairer system in which we were looking for a greener future.
Describe to us your vision of a greener world.
So much of sustainability feels like it's being taken away. You know, I think that's what's going to in the future be the political thing. So, you know, they're going to make your homes colder and they're going to make you not be able to drive your car. And it goes away from the fact that sustainability can give us so much. You know, I learned to sort of ride properly around London during the lockdown, and it's completely changed my life. You know, there's things that we do that make things much, much better. So I think and would be easier if the systems allowed us to have safe cycle routes, for example. And then I think equity is just so important. And we probably haven't talked about it enough on this, but that justice needs to be focused, because there's a huge amount of injustice in the climate movement. There's a huge amount of what we've done in the past and colonialism and the various things that come with it. I think we need to centre inequalities at the heart of all sustainability discussions. And so my greener world would also be a just and equitable one.
Can the health sector become truly sustainable?
I mean, I really hope so. And that's what keeps me working on it. I suppose we've talked about a lot about prevention and what we want healthcare to look like. And I suppose that's what my true sustainable health system looks like, is that we are looking after healthy people, and that the people that we are treating when illness comes along, we're doing that in the best way for them and the environment. And I think we have a system in which we rely on a healthy planet to maintain healthy people. And so therefore, I think we have to have a sustainable health system that reflects that.
Tamsin, thank you again for making the time to talk to us today. You are inspiring such momentum within the field of general practice, and I can say that I've seen firsthand the impact of the tools and the programs you're creating within the area. So thank you so much, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what else is in store in terms of general practice and sustainability.
Thanks so much. And thanks for all the work that you've done in the fantastic series of podcasts. I've really enjoyed listening to the other people on here as well.
EcoMedics is a non-profit organisation challenging health professionals and the healthcare industry to recognise the urgency of the climate crisis and to implement change to become sustainable. To stay up to date with our projects and events, and for climate news and sustainability tips, make sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram @eco_medics, and sign up to our newsletter using the link below or by heading to newsletter.ecomedics.co.uk. Lastly, don't forget to check out our website, www.ecomedics.co.uk, where you can calculate your carbon footprint, carbon offset your unavoidable emissions, access step-by-step sustainability guides, and buy from our non-profit shop with carefully selected sustainable partners. Ecomedics is run by a team of volunteers, and all proceeds go into the running costs of the organisation. If you want to show your support, you can also donate by heading to buymeacoffee.com/ecomedics. Thank you so much again for tuning in, and don't forget to share this episode with friends and family and on social media. Bye for now.